You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 20th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. Urbanism Uncovered, Pinnipeds and Politics Between the Covers, and two experts on Canadian print journalism. All that coming up on Edition 8 of The Stack, today from Toronto. Also coming up on the program, we jump south of the border to visit a family paper mill in Brooklyn who've been focusing on niche luxury paper products.
We're now marketing papers that have embedded magnets in it. We're selling non-paper substrates like poly, vinyl. So we're focusing on working with digital printers and supplying substrates, not all necessarily paper, that fits the needs.
And we speak to the editor of La Revue Longcourt to hear how the new magazine is making a mark on prison kiosks.
It's about travel and the sea. You imagine traveling around the world when you see this title.
All that ahead over the next 55 minutes or so here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Edition 8 of The Stack. This week, coming to you from the studios of the CBC's Broadcast Centre in Toronto, I'm Tyler Brûlé. It's been a significant week in the world of North American print as Newsweek announced it's going out of the paper buying business and will only exist in a digital format moving forward. And here in Toronto, Monocle opened a new bureau complete with shop just down the way at 776 College. We'll be talking about the demise of the Newsweekly and much more today with our very special Torontonians. And our two guest magazine reviewers are sitting here eagerly, ready to work through their stacks of magazines. The first is April Lindgren, an associate professor at Ryerson University's School of Journalism, my old alma mater for a very, very brief moment, director of the Ryerson Journalism Research Center, who also leads the local news research project at the School of Journalism. Before joining Ryerson, she worked as a political journalist in Ottawa and Toronto. April, welcome to The Stack.
Thank you very much.
How is everything at my old school?
Well, we're busy producing journalists now, not print journalists, not TV journalists. We're producing journalists.
And did that mean they have to be, I mean, we talked about when I was there, they were talking about sort of tri-media. What do they have to be? Quad media, quint media today?
Oh, yeah, everything plus.
Right. And is again, going back to the early days, and I'm thinking, goodness, late 80s when I was there, there was just a little red brick box, but it's obviously grown into being really probably one of the leading, if not the leading school now. Where do you see yourselves?
We would like to think so.
but there's one school in Ottawa that that takes issue with that or not?
Well, I happen to graduate from that one in Ottawa, but right. My allegiances have shifted, I must confess.
Excellent. Also joining us in the studio is editor and co-publisher of The Walrus, John McFarlane. John was formerly editor-in-chief of Toronto Life and publisher of Saturday Night. In 2008, he joined The Walrus to oversee an editorial and art direction overhaul. And it's a fine-looking title these days.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about The Walrus for those who might be listening in New Zealand and the outback of South Africa and elsewhere. Where does The Walrus sit in the landscape in Canada?
The Walrus is a magazine about Canada and its place in the world. So you could call The Walrus a parochial magazine. But there's no reason for a magazine like The Walrus to exist in any other form because otherwise you'd be attempting to do what The New Yorker does or The Atlantic or Harper's do. And in a tiny country like Canada, you simply don't have the resources to produce a magazine that can compete with those international titles. So the only reason for a person to buy a magazine like The Walrus at a newsstand when they could also buy The New Yorker or Harper's at The Atlantic is that The New Yorker, Harper's, and The Atlantic don't talk about Canada, don't write about Canada.
But when you say that, though, if you look at, you know, here we are sitting and broadcasting today from the heart of the CBC. And, you know, sometimes, you know, when I'm in other parts of the world, I look at what this network used to be. And I think, you know, is there not a role for a Canadian global, whether it's news organization or publishing organization. And it can just happen to be based in Toronto or Montreal or somewhere else, but it can be as relevant to anyone else in the world. Do you think that, you know, I guess both of you, and well, all of us, I guess, as Canadian journalists, that sometimes we have to sort of think within this prism of Canada only, as opposed to thinking we can actually be global when the Four Seasons have done it. They're global. Bombardier is global. They don't think about just putting trains on Canadian tracks.
I used to make that argument 25 years ago. I used to say Runner's World, which was a magazine that I then read and which was published in some little place in Washington State. I used to say Runner's World could as easily have been invented in Calgary or Edmonton or someplace. And I believed it, and I guess I still believe it. But if you're doing, if you're not doing something which is very niche, it's difficult to publish in Canada for the world.
Hmm. And would you agree with that? Because you have to present, of course, an optimistic view. And just before we went on air, we were talking about that sense of entrepreneurialism and being able to, you know, instill that sense of, yeah, if you're going to be a journalist, it helps if you're also probably a good salesperson these days. What's your view on that, April?
Well, I think that what makes something special and what's going to make, for instance, a Canadian audience interested in it to begin with is something that tells them about themselves. And I think people are attracted by stories that they can relate to. And in a multimedia world, there's an endless amount of content about everything else, about what's happening in South Africa or France. But, you know, the market, to tell a story about what's happening in Canada is a really compelling story, I think, for people who are here. They can find a lot of stories about everything else that's happening in the world. I mean, I take your point that you want to appeal to an international audience, and why not think on that level? But maybe I'm parochial, but I think that that stories that affect people and that they can relate to in their own backyard are really valuable stories, and it's what Canadians can do because they know where we're coming from. I mean, certainly there are lots of really fine journalists who are working all over the world and telling stories from all over the world. But that sort of Canadian perspective on it, or what's happening here and telling our stories to the world, I think is a pretty compelling case, business and otherwise.
Let me turn it back at you.
Sure.
Could either Wallpaper or Monocle have been published in Toronto, headquartered in Toronto and published in Toronto?
No, probably not. But
I think
I say that, and I was driving around town today, and I was thinking, you know, if there was some, you know, something horrendous happened in London, and you know, you had to move your business for whatever reason, you know, where else would you go? Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe there's a point maybe when your brand is strong enough, and of course you want to go where the talent is, too. So I think that, you know, the one thing that keeps us in London is just the really the diversity, and I sort of don't use the probably diversity in the sort of the politically correct term the sense of political correctness that everyone uses it, but just the sheer fact that you have so many people from all over the world and a lot of journalists who are drawn and great art directors and many other people who are drawn to London as this incredible hub. And I would think that you would end up oddly with a largely Canadian narrative.
And the same could be said about New York. You know, the talent pool in New York is so huge relative to the talent pool, even in a city the size of Toronto.
Right.
That makes it very difficult to
We should probably say that no shortage of Canadians. I know you want to make a point, but John has given me the absolute perfect segue to this next package that we're going to listen to. Because if there's one industry that surely felt the shocks of the digital age, the paper business is it. Declining demand for paper and industry consolidation have dealt a tough hand to what was once a thriving component of the American economy. As small mills across the country struggle to survive in an increasingly digital era, New York-based Mohawk has cornered the market by offering top-quality products and seizing a growing demand from Asia and Latin America. Rather than decreasing the quality of their offerings, the family-owned business has refocused their model to capitalize on niche demands for luxury papers, a move that's profitable for the 81-year-old company. Monocle's Barrett Austin recently caught up with Thomas O'Connor Jr., Mohawk's chairman and CEO, for a look at how he's managed to steer his family's business towards success in an ever-challenging market.
we run anywhere from 98 to 102 inches. The mill we have 2 miles north in Waterford, two paper machines, 78, and then we can go 56 inches on the smaller one.
My name is Thomas O'Connor, Jr., and I'm chairman and CEO of Mohawk in Cohoes, New York. Mohawk has been around since 1931. I am the third generation. My son joined the business several years ago, so we have the fourth generation. Harvard Business School would tell you that my generation, the third, is the one that runs it into the ground. I have an 11% chance of success. We're trying very hard to beat those odds. But basically, I'm overseeing the change and the transition of our businesses to fit the evolving technologies of the world.
How has this business changed in the past, say, 10, 15 years?
Well, it's changed dramatically. I mean, nobody can argue that the usage of paper is down. But, you know, there are also some bright spots where, you know, usage is increasing. And we're trying to focus on those high-end markets that are growing.
And if we were to go back to the early days of this company's history, how was the company started? What's its focus been through the years, and how has it evolved?
Well, if you go back to 1931, when my grandfather took over, we made primarily school construction paper, which was very inexpensive, deep-dyed colors, black, red, and orange. We found out after about 20 years, although I wasn't there then, that is not a very desirable market to be in. So we transitioned in the mid-40s to printing papers, and we started making a grade that we still make today, which is our flagship brand, Superfine, in about 1945. And we transitioned into all printing papers back then. And then over the years, we have just moved into different markets and developed other printing papers depending on the technology that's being used.
And if you could just walk us through where your focus is right now, which industries are you supplying? Where's the focus today?
Well, we're trying to keep our core business stable, which is text and cover, which is premium uncoated paper. Colors, textures, writing papers, cotton fiber papers. So there's a focus there to maintain that market share or grow the market share. The markets aren't growing. Our other focuses have really been on photographic paper and digital paper and specialty substrates. We're now marketing papers that have embedded magnets in it. We're selling non-paper substrates like poly, vinyl. So we're focusing on working with digital printers and supplying substrates, not all necessarily paper, that fits the needs.
Well, we had the pulp with 7% consistency. What we have right now is 1% consistency. Runs around 130 degrees Fahrenheit. From this point, it goes onto the wire of the paper machine and we'll make paper out of it.
If we were to consider your business from a quality perspective, where has demand gone in recent years? Has there been a shift towards a focus on better quality? Has it declined? Where is quality going?
Well, I think in the traditional paper markets, it's like everything. It's what I would call the Walmart mentality. You know, pricing is going down, and people are using a lot of papers that I would call can print. They can print. We're trying to distance ourselves from those markets. We don't make any of those types of papers, so we're really focused on our luxury. We look at ourselves as a luxury brand. People are going to have to pay more for our papers, so we need to give them something that is going to they'll be able to derive a benefit by using those papers.
And looking at your business from a global perspective, where have you seen increased demand in recent years?
In high-end digital papers and photographic papers. I would say that's really the areas that we're focused on, but it's the only areas that I've seen growth.
But also looking internationally, which countries do you notice demand? There's been some expansion of your business into Europe in recent years, hasn't there?
Yeah, we have an office in King's Kettle, Scotland. We have 4 people on the ground on the continent. Europe is slow these days. I mean, we're where we want to be, where we budgeted this year, but we're not seeing a lot of growth. Where we have seen a lot of growth has been in Asia. China, Hong Kong, the Australian market is very good for us, and we're starting to do more in South America. But I would say the least strong market out of all those would be continental Europe. We've had the White House stationery for a number of administrations. I'm not going to betray my bias in politics today, but an order's an order, so we don't really care who's in the White House as long as we're supplying the stationery. You will see in the lobby as well, we've provided all of the jackets for the Harry Potter series. We've worked very closely with Scholastic on that, and, you know, it's been very good business for us. We're sorry that she's not writing any more books.
And if you were to sort of forecast the next decade for Mohawk, what do the next 10 years look like for you?
I think we have to continue to build our online presence. As I said, I don't think paper is going away, but I think how it is being distributed, it's a supply chain. I mean, I just read an article recently in the Wall Street Journal that said that there could be no more use for electronic stores. I mean, you're talking about Best Buy, Radio Shack. You know, I don't want to become one of those companies. And one of the issues is, you know, that our distribution, our traditional distribution, has a very difficult time delivering small orders and making money. We're working very hard at developing that supply chain that we can ship and make money on small orders, because in aggregate, it's an awful lot of paper that I think some of our customers are walking by.
That was Thomas O'Connor, Jr., Mohawk's chairman and CEO, speaking with our Barrett Austin. I wanted to pick up with both of you. Maybe we'll keep it in New York as well. Of course, earlier in the week, we saw Newsweek saying that they are moving out of the paper business and they are going to be just an online venture. What do you make of that, April?
Well, an optimist would say we're increasingly journalists are being freed from the tyranny of paper, because the thing about moving to online is that you have endless amounts of space and opportunity and all sorts of different ways to tell stories that really expand the opportunities and the ways of telling stories that we usually are confined to when you have a paper product.
Mm. Would you say that that's also just part of the problem as well, having an endless amount of space? Aren't we better sometimes when we can sharpen our word and are confined to, well, what might pass for an A4-sized piece of paper?
I'd say that. I also think that we have to be careful about how we frame the demise of Newsweek. You know, it's being talked about as a kind of victory for digital media over paper. But the reality is that Newsweek has been, all the Newsweeklies, frankly, all the American Newsweeklies have been in decline for 20 years. And this was simply the end of the line. If Newsweek had still been owned by the Washington Post or a big corporation like that, it might still be alive. But it doesn't have that kind of backing anymore. Time also is suffering, but because it's owned by Time Inc.,
hard to get rid of your flagship title,
exactly.
Probably.
But this is really the decline and fall of the Newsweekly more than it is, as I say, a victory for whatever over paper.
Mm. Yeah, I think just the idea of weekly is the problem. I mean, people want their news instantly now, the minute they click on the key. And, you know, the weekly element to it is, it's been, I think, just eclipsed by the immediacy of news.
Mm. But wouldn't we say from this side of the border, you know, looking down at the United States, and I mean looking down just that we're on a higher latitude here than anything else, that when you look at the U.S. market, sometimes I think that it's become almost a theme on this program, that the U.S. have actually talked themselves out of paper altogether. It's wonderful to hear Thomas O'Connor Jr. talking about paper, but it just seems that there's such a strong West Coast dialogue, and everyone wants to listen to what they say out of Silicon Valley, and that, of course, affects what's going to happen on Wall Street, and it seems to be fashionable because everyone wants the Apple share price to go.
I'm not sure they've talked themselves out of it, as they've just been backed into a corner, and they're trying to adapt and survive and produce news in some format on some sort of platform.
Mm.
As I heard him speak, and he was talking about adapting to circumstances, it occurred to me to think again, as I have for many years, that new media have not traditionally killed old media. They force old media to adapt in some way, and the old media that do adapt carry on.
Mm.
I mean, people are still, you know, television was a huge shock to the print media 40 or 50 years ago, but it survived. And, you know, the electronic media was a huge shock to book publishing.
Mm.
But we're still reading books.
Indeed. We're going to run away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Stay with us, because after the break, we're going to start working through these fine bits of paper we have in front of us. Stay with us.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
And welcome back to The Stack here in Toronto with me, Tyler Brulé. And we're with John McFarlane of The Walrus and also April Lindgren from Ryerson's School of Journalism here in Toronto. Now, of course, you've been both very well behaved, bringing a number of different titles. And April, where do you want to start with the pile in front of you today?
I'd like to start with Spacing Magazine.
And tell us a little bit about, I should start, Spacing Magazine is quite interesting, if we sort of look at the word, in that the magazine is actually in a, you know, very interestingly, it's in a landscape format, as opposed to, being a typically vertical title.
Yeah. And the subtitle is Canadian Urbanism Uncovered. And there, I think they attract attention with the layout. It's really noticeable when you walk into a newsstand to buy it. And what they are really about city, living in cities and the space of cities. And they don't just confine it to the public space. They look at sort of the political space and the space for dialogue. And I think they've done a great job of focusing on these issues. They started out just, they publish three times a year a Toronto issue, and then they also have a national issue once a year that they also sell.
Mm. John, do you think that this is almost a magazine for its time in a way? Of course, there have always been journals about urbanism and city planning, etc. But I think a lot of people know certainly the pressures on this city, and of course, many other metropolises across this country. So is this a title of its time?
I think you could make that argument. I wish that more people were reading Spacing because I think that the city in which we're speaking right now would be a healthier city if its residents were better informed about municipal affairs.
Mm.
You know, municipal affairs has been the kind of poor child of politics during my lifetime. You know, if you're interested in national politics, you might be interested in provincial politics, but municipal politics was deemed dull and boring.
Right.
And it's anything but. It's where all the action is today.
And yeah. April, it's interesting because you raised the point earlier that you said there's almost perhaps an advocacy, or it's good if the future journalists that you produce can really own this type of territory and inform the electorate of why they should be concerned about street widths and building heights and the various ordinances that go with cities.
Well, I actually teach a course that is all about cities and how they work and the role of news media in cities. And I always make the case to my students at the beginning of the year, they're master's level students and they come from all different backgrounds. And I always make the case that in my class, I'm there to convince them that local journalism is where it's at. And of course, everybody wants to be a foreign correspondent. And I say, well, I hope by the time we're through with this course that that I'll have convinced you that you can, local news has all of the issues that arise internationally. It's about values and ethics and conflicts and quality of life and people living well or people not living well and equity issues. And you can tell all those stories at a city level.
Do you really think that most students, when they come in, they still want to be foreign correspondents? When we look at, we can think about the Stryker Maguires and all of the great names that used to be on the Newsweek masthead. Has there been a shift now?
Well, I would say they want to be foreign correspondents or entertainment writers.
Right.
And so I really work hard to sell them on an alternative vision of their future.
John, this country, I think probably most of our listeners would know, Canada's been very good, particularly in the broadcast space, of sending a number of fantastic journalists around the world, and there are still a lot of Canadians who everyone thinks are Americans, but in fact they hold Canadian passports, who are working for U.S. networks and many other networks. I mean, if you look at Al Jazeera English, etc. But you know, the same question to you: do you think that there is that dream, or is the dream gone of all of those fresh young faces coming into who are in class right now at this time of year, that they're going to get a nice gig in Jakarta someday, or their byline, or they'll be signing off from Santiago?
I still think that's the principal dream of many, if not most, serious young journalists, to get out there in the world and report. And many of our finest exports that you refer to in journalism, people like Peter Jennings, were as successful as they were because they did have that background before they took on jobs as anchors.
Sure.
They were real journalists rather than newsreaders.
I also think that the cities and what happens in cities is holding a greater appeal just because so many people live there, and cities are just increasingly bigger players in what happens in the world. You hear about what's happening in London or what's Toronto doing, and there's other levels of government that are obviously on the international scene as well. But cities are increasingly players. And as a result, what happens in them, I think people are more interested to read about and to talk about.
Mm. April, is there still a level of curiosity about the world when you look around the various classrooms at school? And then, and again, we can also, the world can also be confined to the city limits as well. But it is interesting when I've been talking to some Canadian diplomats, they feel that there's a concern that there aren't enough Canadians actually, in fact, going beyond city borders, that there's a comfort. Canada's had such a good run recently, so it's actually a great place to live. But also that impacts our competitiveness, because you need to be able to almost sort of fertilize the fields, as it were, and that means Canadians need to get out in the world. And it was very curious to hear people in diplomacy saying we wish there were more Canadians actually going beyond borders. And I'm wondering if you have any sort of when you look at the fresh crop of journalistic talent that you see.
I'm surprised to hear that, because I mean, almost by definition, we have 500,000 people or more every year who are coming to the city of Toronto, who are coming from some, or not per year, but like in the last, between 2001 and 2006, who immigrated to Toronto. And by definition, those are people and their kids who have ties to other places in the world, and they're going to those other places in the world. And, we are getting some of those students in our journalism classes. I have a student who, goes to Pakistan regularly, and I had her write a piece about what it's like to go back and look at Pakistan through a journalist's eyes after a couple of years in journalism school, as opposed to going back and being just there with her family. And she wrote a very interesting piece about that, and the seeing the sort of inequities that you don't see when you're going back as a member of your family. Mm. So I think there's lots of opportunities, and I'm kind of surprised to hear those guys saying that.
Do you know what the largest expat Canadian community, where it lives in the world?
Mm. You want me to choose a city or a country?
A city.
Mm. And that's a tricky one. Well, is it only south of the border? No.
It's south of the border.
Oh, goodness. Los Angeles.
You're right.
Oh.
There are a million people with Canadian passports living in Los Angeles. And this is to your point about, do Canadians get out?
Right.
There are a million in Los Angeles, and there are about half that number in New York.
Right. And then I wonder if it's, maybe not half that number again, but then in the rest of the world. But I think
Hong Kong might be third.
Yeah, but I think I have to say the Aussies, if we're talking about Commonwealth, I think the Aussies have won that one. The Aussies are dominating Hong Kong, it seems. I just want to pick up on one point, which I think is really curious, that do you think that we've been pulled from a media point of view closer to the United States, in Canada? Because I think if I would have rewind a quarter century ago, I think we used to, rightly or wrongly, we used to take a bit of a snooty view about the U.S. newscast, and even then, thank God, it was so domestic and it wasn't international enough. And we would always uphold one of the bulletins that came from this building, or still does come from this building, the National and the Journal and all these great programs that we had. But watching national news now, I feel when I come back to Canada as well, it's very domestic. And so What is that symptomatic of April, do you think? And it's interesting, as you say, that you want to encourage people to focus on their cities, but to understand your cities and your environment, don't you also have to have a perspective on the world?
I'd say it comes back to money. I mean, I think if you did a survey of the number of news organizations in Canada that had foreign correspondents permanently posted somewhere, the numbers have shrunk. I mean, there's just no getting around to it. And I've heard estimates that to actually put somebody in a foreign bureau and run it can cost up to about $1 million. Mm. That's a very expensive proposition, and news organizations just aren't doing it anymore. There's a big, big trend towards you have people in your newsroom and you send them out on one-offs. And I don't know. I mean, the argument is you get as good journalism, but I'm not sure I buy it.
Mm. Or
I mean,
streeters.
Yeah, and I mean, I can say, look, we
interview taxi drivers and shoe shine guys.
Right. You know, we just opened a bureau, you know, here, for example, and, you know, of course, we have a dedicated correspondent here, whether we then move someone into the market. But I feel for certain corners, certain pockets of the world, it's absolutely essential that we have our own people in Tokyo. We have our own people. And I think it's part of it is also the old model, which is, you know, it would be interesting for, you know, I would, you know, love to come and talk, you know, at some point at Ryerson about, you know, it doesn't take $1 million to sustain a journalist somewhere. But you can still give them a roof over their head. They don't have to be doing it from the breakfast table either. You can still give them the support network. But I think also a lot of it is those old contracts where you had to move people's grand pianos and everything else across the world as well.
Yeah, I also think there's been a kind of loss of faith. I'm speaking about journalism in Canada. Mm. My own view is that it's being dumbed down, and it's being dumbed down because there's a general belief that, well, and certainly in broadcast, that you have to have the numbers, And in order to get the numbers, you become more domestic, you become more entertainment oriented, and you don't write about so much about or broadcast so much about Libya or Iraq or Palestine.
No, absolutely. We're going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. When we come back, we are going to be chatting to the editor of Paris's L'Encours magazine. Stay with us.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy. And so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, and we are broadcasting from Toronto today. In France, mid-August, a beautifully crafted magazine hit the newsstand. A fusion of a book and a magazine, La Revue L'Encours, offers savvy readers a fresh alternative. Centered around travel, L'Encours mixes literature and journalism in their long-form reports. With no advertising and limited internet presence, L'Encours has been well-received, selling more than 12,000 copies in its first month. Our Alexandra Orne caught up with Tristan Savin, L'Encours editor, to hear more about his new publishing model.
In between journalism and literature, your contributors are journalists, but also writers, novelists.
Yeah.
For instance, you have commissioned articles to writers such as Ala Alaswani. Why is this still journalism or is it literature?
It's a good question, both. It's journalism because it's a magazine, and it's literature because it's a book. And we have both. And I think I am writer too, and I am journalist. you can understand the world better if you ask to a writer to write about the world. We ask to the writer to do reporting like journalists, and it's the result is interesting.
So how did Loncourt come about?
It's the publisher is a big group and Express Group, and we have to change, we have to innovate, and we have a news magazine weekly in this group called L'Express. It's difficult today for a magazine in France to do reporting like this, and we don't have enough pages, and with this kind of books we can have big reporting with 20 pages. It's impossible in a news magazine, actually. Then it's a new experience, and for the journalists, it's very important to have the time and to have the place to tell a story.
Loncourt is similar to La Revue 21 in its approach. Whereas La Revue 21 is well established, in what do you want to differ from La Revue 21?
It's a travel magazine, and we are a literary magazine, and that's why we ask to writers from all over the world to write some stories for us, and I think this is the difference, yeah, because it's not reporting only, and we try to understand the world. And we don't have the same point of view about, it's not political review. You can understand something when you read Loncourt, and writers are very important for that. And this is an important difference, yeah.
You've been a journalist and a writer for many years. Today, editor-in-chief of Loncourt.
Yeah.
Did you imagine this?
Yeah, it was a dream since 20 years. I tried to do this magazine many times in my life, and it's an old dream for me, and I'm very happy to do this now because it's a fantastic project, and the result is beautiful, and I'm very proud to be the editor-in-chief. It was a dream. And I'm very lucky.
And that was Tristan Savin, Loncourt's editor, talking to our Alexander Orn in Paris. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment. And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. And today we are in Toronto. John, you have your stack very neatly assembled over there. And where do you want to go first?
Well, my stack is a very traditional stack, I guess. And at the top of it is The New Yorker, which I believe to be the finest magazine, bar none, in the English-speaking world. I can't comment on magazines that are published in other languages, but it seems to me it stands for the best in Western magazine publishing. It's intelligent, it's smart, it's stylish, it's witty, it's thought-provoking, and it's weekly. And in fact, that's often a problem for many New Yorker readers because it's they start to pile up because you can't get through them all.
Yeah, I think there is some type of syndrome that many people have, which is New Yorker panic. And I know that I've always have probably two copies in my bag, and one becomes progressively more shredded, and yet oddly there's something about its format. It's very different. It's not sort of we've got Lapham's Quarterly sitting here. It's not bookish, like that is, yet people do want to hold on to them. And I sort of think that's one of the beauties of The New Yorker is that so many of the pieces, even if it's a current affairs piece, it doesn't actually matter if you go back to it 2 months later.
No, No, well, that's because so many of the pieces it does are definitive. When the New Yorker does a profile of somebody, it is more often than not the definitive profile. No one will be going back there, no one with any sense will be going back there anytime soon. And that just speaks to the quality of the writing and, as you would know, the the intensity of the process. I mean, New Yorker articles take months and months and months to write. They're fact-checked within an inch of their life. They're edited and edited and edited. I mean, it's a, you know, by the time it's published, it has been fretted over for longer than any other magazine can afford to fret over their stories.
Yeah, and you get this beautifully edited journal, which lands on desks and through letterboxes, etc.
And happily, I would argue that the New Yorker, under its current editor, David Remnick, is maybe the best New Yorker of my lifetime. I can't comment really on Harold Ross's New Yorker. Remnick's the fifth editor of the New Yorker.
Yeah.
But I think he's, other than Ross, he's absolutely the best editor of the New Yorker, and himself a wonderful writer, eclectic writer. You know, he can write about the Soviet Union. He can write about Barack Obama. He's awesome.
Mm. I mean, many would say this is Aprilis's one family's indulgence. It's the indulgence of the new houses. And again, I guess depending on who you talk to, it's either never made money or it just barely washes its face. Is that the world that we're going to end up in for quality journalism? Maybe some would say it was ever thus, that it's, you know, this is the role of state broadcasters. That's why they're there. There are these sinkholes, and quality is only dropping now because people are looking for, you know, even returns, in the very building that we're sitting in at CBC in Toronto.
Well, certainly, you know, the business model is broken for a lot of media organizations, and they haven't figured out how to run them. I mean, there are sort of a few niche operations online where people are experimenting with foundations that are running news organizations or doing investigative journalism. But I mean, thank God for families that are willing to eat these sorts of losses forever, because I mean, it's a fantastic magazine, and just the fact that the cover itself is worth collecting, I think, for many people is wonderful.
To both of you, and I want to just maybe draw our listeners' attention to the masthead of the Walrus. I'm also looking at another Canadian magazine, Maisonneuve, as well. And I guess it would be maybe surprising to someone sitting in the UK or many other markets that, you know, John, on your masthead, it says, "We acknowledge the financial support of the Government of Canada through the Canada Periodical Fund of the Department of Canadian Heritage." And so there's a logo for Canada. There's also the Ontario logo, Ontario Arts Council, etc. Can any Canadian magazine apply for funding or grants? I mean, I was looking for that in Spacing. How does that work in this country?
Well, all Canadian magazines, I think, get some of that heritage money. But if what you're getting at is does that in any way, does the fact that we take money, not nearly as much as we'd like, from the government, does it influence how we publish the magazine? I'd say not at all.
No, I wasn't getting at that. I was actually wondering if we have to move to more of a model like that. That in fact, does there need to be, and one sort of recognizing that in a liberal democracy like Canada, there probably wouldn't be interference. And as you said, even though maybe, you know, it does get up the noses of people in Ottawa, nevertheless. But if we're going to be able to do April the New Yorker style of journalism, that there might have to be some level of state intervention.
Well,
or greater,
maybe.
The case may be.
I mean, I think a lot of journalists would certainly be uncomfortable with that on a massive scale. And I think to think that governments wouldn't meddle is a bit naive if it became the norm.
Mm.
I mean, governments do everything they can to sort of control what the media writes about them. And if they controlled the purse strings as well, I think it would be a problematic thing if it happened on a bigger scale.
I mean, this week we saw, of course, another very high-profile story two of the biggest media players in the country, but Bell, who of course have newspaper businesses and of course a lot of broadcasting, not to mention mobile, attempting to take over another media company, and the government quashed it here.
You have to be careful. It wasn't the government that quashed it. It was an arm's length commission.
Sure.
That does not report to the Canadian government that quashed it. The CRTC, the Canadian Radio Television Commission, does not report to the government. The government, for all we know, might have wanted that deal to go through. And I don't really see the difference between taking money from government and taking money from advertisers. I mean, it's the journalist's job to remain independent, and advertisers too, try to influence journalists, and sometimes they're successful, and thankfully, mostly they're not. Mm. But
do you think that when we're speaking to students, that is enough of a discussion, and I come back to what we were discussing about sort of entrepreneurialism before, that oftentimes everyone enters into an editorial environment and I want to be responsible for my pages, and my goodness, I would never want to go out and speak to an advertiser because that's really sort of dirtying my hands. But I mean, I would even say, as someone of course is very much in the publishing business, that's a very naive view, because I always feel that if you can't sell, I'm looking John at your magazine, if you can't sell to Jaguar, then you're probably not going to be able to sell your stories either. I'm not sure. Do you think that April, is that actually probably should be on the curriculum or in schools? Understanding the business of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is, too. We do talk about that. I mean, part of that discussion, though, comes from the place of transparency. So, I mean, if you're doing that, just tell people what you're doing. Mm. I mean, I think the problems are arising now where we're seeing more and more newspapers that are running an advertisement for a product, and then they have some innocuous story that's written about the product that runs right beside it. Well, I mean, maybe the reader knows why those two are placed there, but maybe they don't. But
right.
I think that's moving into a gray area of journalism. So usually these discussions come from the place of transparency. Let's just say, what's going on? What are the interests? And what is this? And then the readers can decide for themselves.
Mm. This has become a much bigger discourse about the state of Canadian journalism than it has been about the magazines piled in front of you. So before we have to sign off, April, where do you want to, what's next? There, you've got spacing. What other title do you want to look at?
Well, because of my interest in cities, I brought in a city magazine, Toronto Life, which John knows very well,
which continues to run and run. I don't know how it's doing, but it is amazing that it's quite curious where it sort of sits. I think within North American magazines as well.
Yeah, I'm biased. I edited it for 15 years, but in the North American context, it's one of the top four or three city magazines in North America.
Right.
I mean, New York Magazine has to come first.
Sure.
And there's some other, Texas Monthly, I would say, is the next
best.
But it's doing all right financially.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I brought it in just because it has this, I find it interesting to pick up every month because it's got this, what I think of as kind of a provocative mix between this focus on conspicuous consumption and sort of the rich and beautiful and what they're up to, mixed in with pieces of journalism that are for the most part, actually pretty good, I think. And they're putting it out on a monthly basis. I mean, they're not New Yorker level explorations of issues,
right?
But they're on topic and they're able to work with the news, which is what I think is a valuable service.
And do you think that they do enough of, when we were talking about Spacing Magazine a little bit earlier, at least maybe in a more popular sense, are they also able to take on some of the same issues that focus on the pressures of maybe not great planning sometimes on the part of the urban affairs department in the city?
Yeah, I mean, there's those issues will crop up. They've had stories recently on the influx of immigrants from Ireland because things are tough over there. They've had a piece they're looking at. Actually, there's a real preoccupation with real estate, which is including a little feature every month of somebody who's looking for a place to buy a house in Toronto, and their hits and misses before they land a place. And among the people who can afford a house in Toronto, which is increasingly a shrinking market,
right?
It's kind of like real estate. State porn. People can't resist it.
I guess, as you said, very, very hard for you to look back maybe on something that, of course, you were in charge of for so long. But are they still doing a good job, in your opinion?
Yeah. And you know, the Toronto Life tries to do what I think Graydon Carter does better than any other editor, magazine editor in North America, which is play high low. That's what I call high low. You know, so in Carter's case, it's, you know, you put the movie star du jour on the cover, but inside the magazine there's some serious.
Some
there's
issues,
Christopher
sure.
Hitchens and some, or there used to be, and some serious journalism, that's essentially the modus operandi of Toronto Life. It's the, you know, P.T. Barnum said you have to get them in the tent.
Now, just before we go, I see you've got Vanity Fair peeking out there, John, but you've already covered that, I'll let you pick the last title of the day.
Well, I think the Atlantic is interesting right now because it's enjoying a renaissance, not just in journalistic terms, but it has turned itself around. It has developed a new business model. It's owned by a very wealthy entrepreneur, but I think he lost, if my figures are right, I think he lost.
He took a soaking for quite a while.
That soaking was a $100 million soaking, as I understand it. But they've turned it around, and they turned it around by developing a really good website and by getting into the conference business.
Yeah.
And those two things are floating the magazine. Those two enterprises are floating the magazine.
And
so it can be done.
No, exactly. And it's interesting that you reference this title and you bring it in because it is it has a great business model, but also journalistically, it engages you still too.
Oh, I think so. I think in the last couple of years, they've started to do, you know, stories like The End of Men. They're starting to do stories that in our office we call The Way We Live Now stories, and they resonate with people.
Yeah, just before we wrap up and go, April, how do you consume magazines? I remember that when I was living in Toronto, I used to love to go to Maison de la Presse in Yorkville in Toronto. They're still there. They've moved. I don't think it's as big as it used to be. But I don't think the range has necessarily decreased. Do you prefer magazines coming through the letterbox, or do you prefer going out and really gathering a big armful?
I'm generally a letterbox girl. Because I get I get Spacing, Toronto Life, The Walrus, and three newspapers a day, and so I'm the recycler's dream actually coming out of my house. But that's my preferred. Time thing.
John, how do you prefer to consume?
I'm both. I love going, especially when I'm traveling. Well, I love going into a newsstand at an airport and buying 5 to 10 magazines. I know it's maybe irresponsible, but I love doing it.
It's going to be interesting to measure people's biceps in the future as well, because I think, you know, true consumers when they travel, I definitely think it definitely puts on muscle mass. And I think, you know, as we sort of move to for better or worse to a tablet based society, I think people just only carrying a Kindle. I mean, you know, what's that going to do for your upper arms? One wonders. But thank you very much for today. It was great being back in Toronto.
Pleasure.
And April, I really look forward to hopefully coming to Ryerson at some point. And John, it would be wonderful to collaborate with The Walrus. Thanks very much.
Great. It's a date.
Very good. We look forward to that. Today's program was produced by our Don Trump in Toronto and also Gillian DeBias, of course, you know very well here at Monocle 24, former Toronto girl for the moment, but of course heading back to London with us as well. Our studio manager here at the CBC was Tim Lorimer. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time, back in Studio One at Midori House. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. Most importantly, you can also visit our new outpost in Toronto every day of the week at 776 College Street. For now, from all of us here in Toronto, I'm Tyler Brulé. Goodbye. Have a good weekend.